Okay. As I said, it's a basic law of nature that every scholar who says one thing is absolutely true, another one will say, no, it's absolutely wrong, and present something totally different. The main point here, I think you can see very obviously, is the duplication, the repetition, the fact that there are two introductions, two sets of instructions, everything happens twice. For us, that's an obvious clue, obvious question, why? Because for us, that's not normal. I think I can say that for the flood story, that's the main point. Without that repetition, this whole thing would really not be very convincing at all. It's the repetition that makes it really a strong case. And while it's very, very true that for us, this is strange, we always have to remember that the Bible was not written by us. It was not written by Europeans in modern times. It comes from a very, very different culture. And so before we say that is a problem we have to solve, why is there so much repetition? We have to spend some time getting to know the ancient culture and their ancient style of writing. And if you do that, then all of a sudden everything changes, because very quickly you will realize that repetition is actually extremely common. For example, here is a nice little poem, beginning of a nice little story called The Descent of Ishtar to the Netherworld. It's Akkadian. Akkadian is the language of ancient Babylon, Assyria. It's a related language and related culture to Hebrew. It's Semitic, ancient Semitic. So here it is. To the land of no return, the realm of Eresh-Kigal, Ishtar, the daughter of Sin, set her mind. Yea, the daughter of Sin set her mind. To the dark house, the abode of Irkala, to the house which none leave who have entered it, to the road from which there is no way back. And it continues. The story goes on in much the same style. Now, what do you notice? Repetition? It's very repetitive, extremely repetitive. Four times it says she is going somewhere. Four times it says that. Twice it says she decides or sets her mind. Oh, actually, in the Estonian, they just translated it the same. Otsustas, otsustas. I guess in English, it's the same too. Never mind. Twice it says she decides to go. Four times it says she goes. Repetition is obvious. Now, do you notice contradictions within the story? Where is she going? To a country or to a house? Well, it's told in different ways. Once it's called a house, the other time it's called, first it's called a country. Then it's called to a house. Who is she going to see? Is it Eresh-Kigal or Irkala? Those are two different names. Who is she going to visit? Repetition, contradictions. All right, let's go to another one. This is now Sumerian, so it's no longer Semitic, but Sumerian is where Abraham is from. It's in many ways the parent culture of the later Semitic cultures. So it's a different language, but they formed the foundation of the later Semitic culture. So it's culturally, they're very, in many ways, very close. Dumuzi and Inanna, the ecstasy of love. By the way, the titles are modern. That's what modern scholars call it. But here it goes. Last night as I, the queen, was shining bright. Last night as I, the queen, was shining bright. As I was shining bright, as I was dancing about, as I was uttering a song at the brightening of the oncoming night, he met me. He met me. The Lord Kuliana met me. What do you notice? Extremely repetitive. Extremely repetitive. And you could go through pretty much every text that has been dug up out of the sand from the ancient world of Israel, from that larger cultural world. And this repetition is everywhere. In other words, we're not actually dealing with a problem that has to be solved. We're dealing with a style, a cultural style that is very repetitive. And it, actually, if you'd continue at some point, for some reason, I can't quite remember why, in a bookstore or something, I picked up a copy of something you've definitely heard of, I'm sure. 1001 Arabian Nights. You've heard of Aladdin. That's the most famous of the stories of these. They're Arab fairy tales, Arab stories from about the 14th century after Christ. I mean, it's relatively modern, but I started reading through the original Arabian Nights stories, and the repetition is still there. It's still part of the culture, even thousands of years later. Not as much, but it's still there a little bit. In other words, this is definitely a very basic part of the cultural style of storytelling or writing from that part of the world. Now, just out of curiosity, I wonder if any of you can think of another culture where repetition is a traditional part of storytelling. I'll make it very simple by pointing in this direction. Estonian, Regilau, Estonian traditional musicals. I mean, it's storytelling in music in many ways. It's extremely repetitive. Everything is repeated. If you ever actually open Kalevipoeg and read it, I actually have read the English translation of Kalevipoeg, and it's painful because it's impossible to translate the rhythm from Estonian into English, the rhythm, but it's so repetitive. Kalevipoeg is so repetitive, exactly like this. I mean, very different culture, but the repetition is a common trait, just in that case by coincidence. The point is, repetition that we see in the flood story is actually completely normal within the cultural style of writing from that period, right, from that culture. But these theories, source criticism, started 150, 200 years ago, long before these texts were translated. These texts, the two I gave you and all the others, were buried in the sand. They were discovered much, much later. And then the language had to be translated. So at the time the theories developed, they did not know as much about the ancient style of writing as we do now. Okay, so the repetition, in my opinion, is consistent with the style of the culture. It's not something that we need to divide the text based on the repetition. If that's true, you have to divide every text from the ancient world, which becomes nonsense. But okay, what about the contradictions? If repetitions is not a major problem, in my opinion, what about the contradictions between within the story? Is that something that points to a different author? How many animals went on the ark? Seven of every kind or two of every kind? If you actually take the time to open your Bible and read through the story, what you will find is it says seven of every clean animal. In other words, it's making a difference in terms of the type, because clean and unclean animals is a very important theme. They need animals for sacrifice. They need animals for food. And so taking seven of every clean animal is logical in many ways. Now, the way it is recorded is for us is very strange, very seemingly chaotic. Why they're told at different parts in the story, we would probably put them together and we would tell the story much more concretely. But again, it's not our culture. So we need to be careful about making a big issue out of that. Okay, what about the length of the flood? Now, at least one of you has opened your Bible. Is there a contradiction in terms of the length of the flood? What does it say here about 40 days? What happens for 40 days? Siob. Exactly. For 40 days, the rain comes down. And for 150 days, what? The water is over the earth. Are those the same things? No. We've all been in rainstorms, thunderstorm, where a lot of water comes down, and a lot of water comes down in a very short period of time. But then how long does it take before the ground dries up? Much longer. Those are two different stages. Is it a contradiction that we need to make a point about, make an issue, try to explain? No, it's a logical part of the story. And that's what I wanted to point out is, and as I said, the flood story is considered the strongest example of source criticism. It is considered their best, clearest example. But that's not really a very clear, strong contradiction. In fact, I'm absolutely sure all of you have read Genesis 6 and 7 many times. Did you ever notice a contradiction when you were reading it? No. Because when you read the story, it makes sense. You only notice a contradiction when I put it like this and separate it. Is the contradiction real or is it artificial? In many cases, it'll be the same thing that someone will say this is a contradiction, but when you actually look into it, not really. One of the issues that I have with source criticism, and that many scholars with much higher education levels than I do criticize source criticism, is for oversimplifying. Oversimplification. For example, claiming a theological difference and disagreement between Noah finding grace and Noah being righteous. And they'll say, there you go, that's a theological disagreement. Is it? Really? Can you imagine one sermon by one pastor on one Sunday that talks about both grace and being righteous? Pick on the Lutheran here. Can you imagine Martin Luther talking about both the grace of God and righteousness at the same time? This is where you say, yes, absolutely. I mean, Martin Luther would absolutely connect these, and every pastor should be able to connect these because they're both a part of our understanding of salvation. They go together. To separate them and say this is obviously a different author speaking is a theological oversimplification. But source criticism does this regularly. For example, as I said, in the P version, it says, or they say, that God is presented as transcendent, the king on his heavenly throne, whereas in the J version, God is presented as very close and intimate and personal, immanent or transcendent. Is that a contradiction? Again, absolutely not, because we believe both. Both are true, and both can be used at the same time to emphasize different points. It's not a contradiction. The tendency to oversimplify is a problem all the way through. And in some of the criteria that I gave, and I said some of it is logical, like a change in style, difference in vocabulary. That can be proof of plagiarism of a different author. Absolutely. But at the same time, one author is capable of using different styles, different vocabulary. A good author is very able to do that. We expect a good author to be able to change his style in order to communicate something a little bit different, to make his writing interesting and good. And so we have to be careful in using these. Typically, source criticism has the weakness of oversimplification, of limiting the biblical author to one theological idea or one style. This is seen, for example, very often with the prophets. If you read some of the books in Estonian, there's a number of books on Old Testament that were published a long time ago, and we don't require them for reading anymore for many reasons. But some of these books will say, this prophet was a prophet of judgment. And so this chapter in the prophet must be from a different source, because it's not judgment, it's about salvation and hope. And so that's a different source, because this was a prophet of judgment. Or the opposite, this was a prophet of hope and salvation. Therefore, the message of judgment here belongs to a different source. And again, you got to ask yourself and just think logically. Can you imagine a sermon from one pastor where he talks about both judgment and salvation? If the answer is no, then I really am worried about the church you are a part of. Because they have to go together. Judgment without salvation is horrible. Salvation without judgment is empty. I mean, they're both essential to our salvation, to our theology, to our understanding of God and us and everything. And source criticism, by trying to divide, ends up oversimplifying in a way that I think is not in any way helpful. Now I'll give you a chance. And do you want to comment anything more about this flood example? Okay. I won't force you. As I said at the beginning, and I think I showed, some of the logic of source criticism there's some logic to it. It's not totally wrong. Some of the criteria is valid. Sometimes a drastic change in style can show a different author. No question of that. But at the same time, we have to be very careful about that. Change of thought, change of viewpoint,
Because what I might think is a drastic change, somebody else might say, wait a minute, look at it from this perspective over here. And you can see these two ideas actually fit together beautifully. It's not a contradiction. It's actually showing something beautiful and amazing and just something deeper than maybe we had expected. So we need to be careful with it. It's a difficult criteria to use. And in some ways, that's why I think it's good. Actually, I'll use a personal example. Since I mentioned the plagiarism example, when I was a student, I was accused of plagiarism. I was not guilty. But this is in a big school with much bigger than ours, like thousands of students or some, I don't know how many. And so the professor had a grading assistant. It was a 4-year program. So he would have a 4th-year student. And I was 3rd-year at that point. He had a 4th-year student who was very smart and had good grades who would help him grade papers because one teacher could not possibly grade 300 students. There's no time. So he would have assistants grading. And his assistant thought I was plagiarizing. And I went to the teacher and I said, no, these are my thoughts. And the teacher accepted it. It's very difficult. Now we just can upload it to this computer program and the computer program shows exactly word for word where it's from. So if we're suspicious, we can do it technically in a way that's obvious and definite. But if you don't have that, it's actually very difficult to be able to judge. Is it the same author and he's just very creative? Or is he copying someone else? It actually, in reality, can be very difficult to judge. So I don't blame the person who accused me of plagiarism. Maybe I was just smarter than he was. It happens. But you have to, when you look through these theories, you always have to ask yourself, is this convincing? Because I need to repeat what I did mention this in the last block of classes. This is purely theoretical. There is no proof. There is no evidence, really, no hard evidence. How would you prove absolutely that this theory is true? Now I want somebody to say something because this is not that difficult a question. How would you absolutely prove that this is true?
We have the original texts.
If we have the original texts, exactly. Very simple. If we would dig out from the sand somewhere in ancient Israel, a version of the flood story that only has this section, and is older than the time of Moses, an ancient version of the flood story with only this section, that would be proof that this section existed independently. But that has never been found. There is no real physical evidence of any of this. For the whole documentary hypothesis, for all of this, there's no manuscript evidence. It is purely an internal reconstruction. It's a theory based on what they see in the text, which means we have to ask ourselves, is it real or is it fake? Is it artificial? Fake is a bad word. Sounds bad. Is it real or is it an artificial theory? C.S. Lewis, my favorite author after God. The Bible's the best. After the Bible, I like C.S. Lewis. He was not a Bible scholar. Don't go to him for Bible scholar type stuff. That's not his area.
But he was professionally a teacher of literature at Cambridge. Actually, he taught at both Cambridge and Oxford, different points in his career. So he is a Cambridge, Oxford level teacher of scholar of literature, ancient English literature, specifically ancient literature. And theories like the documentary hypothesis were not just used with the Bible. They were used with Homer, ancient Greek, you know, Homer, Homeros, with a lot of ancient, classic, old literature. And so C.S. Lewis knew these theories very well, professionally, even if he was not an expert in exactly the Bible application. And he wrote an essay called Modern Theology and Biblical Criticism, where he just discussed this. And he brought in something very interesting. He said, you know, I've written a lot of books, and reviewers often try to guess the process of how I wrote my book, the sources I used, the ideas, what inspired me to write this book, and so on. You know what? They have always been totally wrong. They've never gotten it right. They've came up with creative theories of what inspired C.S. Lewis to write this, what was his sources, and so on. But they're never right. And then he asks the question, if they are wrong consistently with a book that comes from their own culture, their own time period, their own language, how can they possibly expect us to believe they will be right when they're dealing with an ancient book from a totally different culture, totally different language, that they don't speak fluently? It's not their mother tongue. If they can't get it right in our language today, can we seriously expect that they will be right with these ancient languages and ancient texts? That doesn't mean they're going to be totally wrong, but it shows the need for humility. And that's what I appreciate out of that. Now, by the way, just sort of to end this, this approach to the biblical text is in many ways historic. It was very, very popular, extremely popular 100 years ago, 75 years ago. But starting around 50 years ago, it started to become less popular. And so now this is no longer really the popular approach. But for some reason, in Estonian language specifically, there have been a number of books that decades ago were translated that already were 50 years old when they were translated. And these ideas seem to be or are still very much around in Estonia and in other countries as well. So we do still need to know about these. But the more recent trend in looking at things like this and these, let's say, differences within the text is not to look at them in terms of different sources and dividing it into different sources, but to recognize that there's actually a very elaborate unity to it. There's an elaborate design, an intentional design in the way the text is written that's very foreign to us because it's written in a very different culture. But to look at it more as the text is, complete, and look at the patterns that exist and the unity that exists within it. But as I said, this is a theory that's had a lot of impact and you need to be aware of it. Okay. Comments, questions? Because I need to change slides. Do I have?
Okay, then let's move to something slightly different. Source criticism was the first methodology that we looked at. The next one we're going to look at is form criticism, or in German, Formgeschichte, which means form history or the history of forms. Sometimes the German, there's a few German phrases that I'll use because all of these ideas were originated in Germany, and sometimes these German words are used. Form criticism is the child of source criticism. Source criticism, as we saw, is the attempt to develop or the attempt to identify what they believe are the written sources that were used to create the biblical book. So the theory is that before the book that we have in the Bible existed, there were written sources that were combined, woven together, edited together to create the finished biblical book. And by the late 1800s, as I said, this is historical. By the late 1800s, source criticism had pretty much done everything it could do, in that they had gone through every biblical book, and especially with the Old Testament, divided, I think we could say, all Old Testament books into their different sources. A little bit in the New Testament, but more Old Testament. Divided them all into their, what they believed were the original sources, which were the written texts that existed before the final biblical text was created. So for source criticism, the author of the biblical book is really an editor who edited together the different sources, combined them to create the final biblical book. Tried to edit out the contradictions as a little bit, but not very successfully. Form criticism now goes one step further back in time, according to the theory that they are developing. And form criticism asks the question, where did these written sources come from? Because the theory is these existed as written sources. So where did they come from? Well, the assumption is that these sources are actually a collection of individual passages that they call pericopes. So, in the beginning, according to form criticism, there existed lots of short little stories, independent little passages, little stories, little poems that existed separately. And then someone collected them. Someone collected these individual passages into the written sources. Some cusimos.
Hey, other. That's probably created fans to set out the invest in I need a lot.
It's this stage here. Yeah. Form criticism is how the sources came to exist. Where did the sources come from in the theory of development that they have here? So in the beginning, there were these separate passages, separate stories. Someone collected them, or actually many people collected them, into the sources. And then years later, the written sources were combined, edited together into the biblical books. So first it's compiling, collecting the sources, bringing them together, or the pericopes, bringing them together into the sources, and then the sources were edited together into the final biblical book. So in the beginning, according to this, these individual little passages floated around, short little stories that had an independent existence. I don't have them. Yeah. And so what form criticism does is to try to identify the little pericopes that were in the sources that became part of the biblical book. So form criticism is trying to go back to this stage here, looking at each little individual passage, analyzing it, well, identifying it first, what is the original little story, and then analyzing it, what can we learn from the original story? Again, what they're looking for is the original. That's what matters to them, the original little passage. And this idea began with an Old Testament scholar named Hermann Gunkel, who lived now at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. And he's the one who really started this, isolating these little passages, these little pericopes out of the text. Now, how did he do that? Well, he has his method, looking for a short passage that has a sequence of similar expressions or similar format. So a little group of passages, for example, or a group of verses, for example, that all begin with the phrase, "You shall not." Okay, if you find somewhere in the Bible a short passage with several verses in a row that begin, "You shall not, you shall not, you shall not." That is a sequence of similar expressions, similar format, which means that probably was originally a separate passage that existed independently. Introductory or concluding formula, second point here. If you see a passage starts, "The word of the Lord came to me saying," well, that's an introductory formula. It's introducing a new passage. And so that probably is starting a new pericope, a prophetic message. Or you're reading through the Gospels and it says, "And then Jesus left that place." Then Jesus left. Okay, that's an end. That's an ending formula, showing the end of what was originally a short independent story about Jesus. And then, last one here, I just put together changes in content, changes in style, changes in the mood. This is basically referring to everything we talked about in source criticism, changes in vocabulary, changes in everything that we talked about in source criticism, they will use as well. So, the Ten Commandments. According to Hermann Gunkel, the Ten Commandments originally existed as a short little passage because it has a series of similar format. You shall not, you shall not, you shall not, right? The Ten Commandments has similar format. It has an introductory formula. How does it begin? How does it begin? Something like, "Then God delivered these commandments." Okay, God gave them these commandments. There's an introductory passage. And so Gunkel says the Ten Commandments originally had nothing to do with Moses, nothing to do with Mount Sinai. The Ten Commandments existed as its own little passage that was passed around by word of mouth for generations as a way to teach the people, to teach their children about what's right and what's wrong. It was its own little pericope, its own little passage that existed independently. Sometime later, maybe hundreds of years later, someone collected it and made it part of a larger written story about Moses, Mount Sinai. But that is a later edition. That's not original. That is part, that larger context is artificial. And Gunkel's form criticism, what matters to them is the original. So take the Ten Commandments out of Mount Sinai, away from Moses, and just look at it separately. That is how we can best understand the original way in which this passage was used, what it meant to the people in the original. The larger story is entirely artificial. So removing it from the context is actually good. Now, do you notice that that's exact opposite of what, wait, did I teach you hermeneutics or did you have Allam? You had Allam, yeah. Before that, I taught hermeneutics. Did Allan say something about reading the Bible in its context? I hope so, because that's really a basic. The basic for interpreting the Bible, we always tell people, read this passage as part of the context. That the context is the key to understand what this verse means. You don't just take this verse out by itself. But that's exactly what Gunkel says we should do. Take this passage, the Ten Commandments, out of the context. That is going back to the original. And that is what matters. So now again, I'm going to ask you, does this sound logical? Or not logical. Let's skip that question. Does this sound like something you have heard before? What? You have not. Are you sure? Because I think you have. It's possible that Irina and Nastya have not. I'm not sure about Maria. You should have heard about this. Indrek, definitely. Anna Kadre, definitely. Probably Otto and Mari too. Just don't know so much about that. Ring any bells? What's the name of the street across here? Somewhere here. No, not Koidula. Isn't there somewhere back here? Kreuzwaldi. Where's Kreuzwaldi? Kreuzwaldi's over there. Kreuzwald. Kalevi Poeg. You see where I'm going? Come on. How is it possible that I know Estonian classic literature better than you do? Okay, Kreuzwald did not write Kalevi Poeg exactly. What did he do? Okay, so for those that did not grow up in Estonia, Kalevi Poeg is the Estonian national epic story. And what did he do? 150 years ago, this guy named Kreuzwald traveled around Estonia and collected individual stories and songs and poems about this person, Kalevi Poeg. And what did he do? He compiled them, wove them together, created an artificial story. I'm guessing Kalevala maybe happened in the same way, Otto and Mari, but I'm not sure. But this is exactly what Kreuzwald did. Notice the time. When did Kreuzwald live? I don't actually remember, but it's about 50. He's about a generation earlier, I think. It's basically the same time period that Gunkel develops this theory about the Bible, and Kreuzwald is doing the exact thing. In Estonia, whoever did it in Finland with Kalevala Germans were doing this. This was a common thing that was happening in 19th century European cultures. And this is exactly what Gunkel says the ancient Israelites did. They had their ancient Kreuzwald, who went around collecting these individual little stories and brought them together to create an artificial national epic. But the national epic is artificial, right? Do you remember that much from school? I hope. Okay, if not, go back and look at it again, because it's exactly the same thing. So if we want to understand the original, then we have to take the Ten Commandments or the individual story out of the context, because that's how it originally existed, independent from the context. So this is how he does it. And then once he has identified the original passage, then he starts to analyze it. And his first question would be to try to determine the genre. Okay, you've got this little passage here. What is the genre that we're dealing with? And genre is something that usually we think of a whole book belonging to a certain genre. But actually, the way they develop it, genre is very, very specific, and it will change within the book. It can change many times. Each passage could have a different genre, because originally each one existed separately anyways. So you can't just say, for example, the letter to the Philippians. What is the genre? It's a letter. Simple. No. Read through Philippians, you get to chapter 2, and you have a poetic section. How does it begin? Our example should be like Christ Jesus, who emptied himself, making himself, taking the form of a servant. In Philippians chapter 2, there's actually a very carefully worded poem in the middle of Philippians chapter 2 that in Greek is recognizable as something unique. And so the common theory is that Paul is quoting perhaps the oldest Christian worship song in praise of Christ. And Paul is quoting this because it's a series, a short section with a poetic style that makes it different from what comes before and what comes after. So you identify the subunit based on the format, the expressions, the style. And then you recognize, okay, what is this? Well, this is a poem in praise of Christ. It's maybe a worship song. That helps you understand it. Okay, if we determine the genre, then the next step for Gunkel would be to compare it with other examples of the same genre. And we are way over time. Sorry, I didn't look at the clock.